This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Maureen Gosling, who is a filmmaker, film editor. She was the co-author, if you want to call it that, of the films, many of the films of Les Blank, best known for a film called Burden of Dreams about the making of the strange film Fitzcarraldo. But over the years, he was also a dynamic documentary filmmaker, died in 2013. There's a retrospective of the films of Les Blank at BAM PFA, Berkeley Art Museum Pacific Film Archive, from June 7th to July 27th. And it will include many of the films. The films are also available right now on the Criterion app, if anybody has that. Maureen Gosling has also been a filmmaker on her own. Among the films are This Ain't No Mouse Music, which is the story of Chris Strachwitz and our Arhuli Records. And Chris Strachwitz was on KPFA for many years doing a show called Panhandle Country. Other films include Blossoms of Fire, which is about the people of Oaxaca in Mexico, A Skirt Full of Butterflies, Bamako Chic, which is in development, I believe.
It's actually finished now.
For more information about the films of Les Blank, you can go to bampfa.org. Maureen Gosling, let's start a little bit about how you got involved with all of these films. Before going into the films themselves, how did you meet Les Blank, and what was he doing when you met him?
I ended up getting a degree in social anthropology from the University of Michigan, but I had this love of film that developed from my first true love, that, you know, who I broke up with. But the love of film remained, even though he had introduced me to foreign films. So I was obsessed with going to movies. And I visited a film class of a friend of mine. A magazine was being passed. My eyes fell on this ad for an anthropological film festival at Temple University in Philadelphia. So I got my nerve up and went. And I met Les Blank at this film festival, and I just thought his films were so beautiful, so poetic, and so different. You know, they were very unusual. I got my nerve up to talk to him at a party briefly. Different things happened. He actually started writing back and forth to each other, and 9 months later, I flew to Hollywood. I felt like I jumped off a cliff because suddenly I was going to be a sound recordist, and I didn't realize that that's what my job was going to be.
Did you know anything about sound recording?
No, I knew nothing. And I just thought that I was going to be his little assistant, right? And he was just going to tell me what to do. I didn't know that I was going to actually have to carry a 25-pound Nagra tape recorder around and a shotgun mic and microphones and have to record music in dance halls. And I got a little bit of help from a friend of his before we went from Hollywood to Black French Louisiana. But it was kind of like, once I was in that situation, no matter how difficult Les was at the time, because he was going through some emotional difficulties, I just knew I couldn't turn back, because this, the world that he opened up was just so amazing. And we were hanging out in Black French dance halls, Zydeco, you know, Clifton Chenier, hanging out with Cajuns and eating gumbo. And it just was this wonderful, wild world that I didn't know existed, you know. It went on from there. We were on our way back to Hollywood, and Les got a call from Denny Cordell, Leon Russell's producer, that they were interested in talking to Les about doing a film about Leon Russell, the rock star who was really quite well known at that point, especially for the Concert for Bangladesh and working with Joe Cocker. So we ended up in Northeast Oklahoma. Les saw the lake where Leon had his recording studio, and he said, "Hey, Leon, I'll do your film, but can you let me edit my Louisiana film at the same time?" Because he saw that lake, and he just wanted to swim and be in nature. And so our first place that we stayed was on this Pappy Reeves fishing dock. It was this little floating motel, and we each had a room, and then there was an editing room with Les's upright moviola that he got from Hollywood flown in. So we were living on the houseboat for a while before we got moved up to better quarters. And so we were able to do exactly what he wanted to do, which was edit what became Dry Wood and Hot Pepper and do the film about Leon.
A Poem is a Naked Person is the name of the film, and it's, I think, only one of three full-length documentary features that Les made over the years. Maybe you could correct me on that. But let's go back to Les himself. How did he get interested in film? Was he a Berkeley person? Because so much of his work is set in Berkeley, and particularly a lot of it, which is about food, is set at Chez Panisse, of all places. So let's go back. How did he get into film, and what year was it that you met him?
Well, he was from Tampa, Florida. And one of the things that I like to bring out that people don't really realize is he was an early, really acknowledged Southern filmmaker. And he had a sensibility that was unique because of that, I think. He grew up in a household that was, you know, we would regard as racist. And he started hanging out with Lightning Hopkins and black blues musicians and sort of was temporarily disowned by his family. But he got interested, I'm not sure specifically, I think he wanted to be a actual Hollywood filmmaker. You know, he wanted to do scripted films. So he tried writing scripts. There were lots of other things that he tried, and I can't remember all of them, but he ended up at Tulane University in New Orleans, and that's when he got exposed to the culture of New Orleans and then also Cajun culture out in the countryside. First, he did move to L.A. He did a lot of industrial films first. He wrote the narration, he shot it, he edited it, and you know, it was for these companies, like chicken companies, and I can't remember them all, but Les Blank's son Herod has been rescuing all of Les's old industrial films. One of the things that he learned from doing those films was process. That's something that I really noticed in his films. When he filmed this woman making, grinding coffee and making coffee and serving it, you could totally follow every step, shot so beautifully. It really informed a lot of his filmmaking. He did a film about Dizzy Gillespie, the black and white film. Then he started working with this guy, Skip Gerson, who's actually going to be at some of the screenings coming up that Les's first early films, the one about Lightning Hopkins, Nance Lipscomb, and Cajuns, Spend It All. They started hanging out with these guys. Skip's father, I think, ended up loaning them some money to be able to shoot the film about Lightning Hopkins. Skip was really good at greasing the social niceties and being funny and hanging out with these guys, and they would play poker with Lightning, and Les realized, oh, I need to let the guy win because he was asking for money, and at a certain point they did give him some money, but that film he regarded as his most poetic and distinctively Les Blank expression.
And that came after the L.A. film, at least chronologically from what I saw.
Which L.A. film?
God Respects Us When We Work But Loves Us When We Dance. And that's from the L.A. Love-In from 68. The Lightning Hopkins film came a little bit later. What I notice about the Lightning Hopkins film is while the text, if you will, is about Hopkins and his music, the subtext, along with food, which we'll get into in a minute, but the subtext is the racism and poverty of the South, which comes across very clearly in that film.
Yes. I think the Lightning film actually came before the Love Inn, or they could have been around the same time because he was living in L.A. and then hanging out in Texas, so he could have been filming them pretty close together. But one of the things that I think is striking about the Lightning Hopkins film, why he regarded it as his emblematic film, is that he found his editing style based on feeling and emotion and connection and music. Anything that could help people connect to people and culture, because there's no reference to time. In other words, the civil rights movement was going on at the very same time as this film was shot. There's no reference to racism. There's no white people in the film. It's all about the culture there. Because it's based on emotion and connection, it has totally held up all these years. The only thing that you notice is the fashions of the people. But the emotions are as contemporary as anything. And I think that is one of the real contributions that Les made and tried to do in his other films that I appreciated and tried to do in my own films as well.
Maureen Gosling, the racism comes across in what they are saying about their lives. And,
oh, yes.
You know, you see that in Drywood and Hot Pepper. It's a subtext that runs throughout those films, along
right.
with the music and the food and the poverty. I interviewed Paul Theroux, who's a travel writer, a few years back. He went through the South, and what he told me was that the poverty there, and so now we're talking after 2010, the poverty there was just as bad as any parts of Africa. So when I saw this film, I realized in some senses, even though this was the 70s, nothing had changed.
It's really true. I grew up partly in Appalachia, too, and saw white poverty, extreme white poverty, southern white poverty. But it's very clear with the people's surroundings and the poverty that they have. And that's the case also in Dry Wood and some of these other films. But I think what Les really found was the way that people survive this kind of thing through culture and music, and also trying to have a different take on those people who would be just dismissed because they're poor and would be dismissed because they maybe aren't as educated or whatever, but look at what they've got, and this is how they've managed to survive. And the music and the culture is a survival tool, as well as just giving people joy that they need with their hard lives.
Well, that becomes very clear, particularly in the detail he gives about the creation of food. In one of these films, we follow the living pig all the way down to people eating. The combination of food, dancing, and music just triumphs in these films, in these early films.
Yes, absolutely. And that, to me, gives them such an emotional complexity because you see the people in their environments and you also can share in the joy of their music and dancing and food. Yes.
So at what point did you start editing?
Okay, I started working with Les in 1972 as a sound recordist and an assistant. And then when we got to Oklahoma, I became an assistant editor as well as sound recordist. He ended up deciding to move to Berkeley. And so that would have been in the early 70s. When I worked with him again, I came out here to work on Chulas Fronteras that he did with Chris Strachwitz. I didn't start to edit till the late 70s. And by that time, he was starting to get tired of editing. So it was this actual wonderful transition where he would give me little tips along the way, and I was very well versed with his films and style by that point and really appreciated so much about it that any time I tried to edit, I tried to, compliment that.
How much footage? Because these documentaries, in fact, all of them that I saw, at least with the single exception of Burden of Dreams, but all of them are primarily collage, which kind of limits the length. You don't want something much more than 45 minutes. But that requires an enormous amount of film and an enormous amount of work putting the film together. So for you, Maureen Gosling, how did that work?
In those days, we were shooting 16 millimeter. That's 11 minutes for one roll of film. You had to keep changing the rolls. So we didn't shoot a lot. And the key was whoever was filming, in this case Les Blank, they had to have a good eye. And Les was careful in what he shot. He could be spontaneous, of course, but he knew what to look for. What he told me early on was the golden moments. And I always loved that because I understood what he meant. He was looking for the emotional expression of people just without saying a word. You could observe people's behavior and understand so much. So he edited in the camera a lot. A Well-Spent Life about the songster Mance Lipscomb was 4-to-1 ratio. Unheard of these days. And that was a 40-minute film. Part of it was that Mance was such an incredible storyteller and so full of philosophy that so much of what he said was worth keeping. Usually the ratio was maybe 15-to-1, 20-to-1 at the most. I think Burden of Dreams might have been 40-to-1. But the other thing is that when Les was turned on, he would shoot really well. You could totally tell. As an editor, I knew when he wasn't turned on because it was lazy. The filming was lazy and, you know, maybe he didn't notice, care about the lighting as much or, you know, he shot too much stuff and it really was not that interesting. The joy was when he was turned on, and that happened a lot with Burden of Dreams. That was both. We had to tell a story, a specific story, more so than some of the other films, which were more sort of, as you say, collages.
Well, the other part of that is that Burden of Dreams also had narration, and most of these films did not have a narration. They would go from place to place to place. I mean, it was specific. You could follow it, but there was minimal, I can't say no narration. Occasionally there'd be a card. But there was basically no narration, which means that if you were going to do it, either you would have to create an invisible narration in your head or it would already be in Les's head. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I loved it myself. I mean, one of the first, besides Burden of Dreams, which was one of the first films I edited from scratch. Almost at the same time, I edited Sprout Wings and Fly, which I don't think is in the program. But that one, it's always finding the story in the footage. In other words, the one thing about 16 millimeter and the limitations of an 11-minute roll meant that there was a limited amount of footage, and sometimes you couldn't just shoot and shoot and shoot everything you wanted, and sometimes you missed stuff that you regretted. And so it meant that you were stuck with the footage you had. And so the story, it's like hunting for the story in the footage. But with Burden of Dreams, we knew we needed a narrator at a certain point, and Les was really reluctant about it. But I thought that there should be a woman narrator because the film was so male. So, you know, a sort of macho story. And I just thought it would be a really nice balance to have a female narrator. And Les just said, oh, I have this friend in L.A. who's an actress. Maybe she can do it. And so we got Candice Laughlin, and she did a great job.
Maureen Gosling, one other aspect which we have to incorporate in this is the way sound works. Now, in those days, you had a recordist doing sound, and then you had silent film, which means you had to sync up both of them, which basically made twice as much editing in a way.
Yeah, because the first part of the process, well, first of all, you had to get a slate. Les had to film me either hitting my hands together, or we had this thing called a bloop light, that the light would shine for a moment at the same moments that it was placing a beep on the tape. And so my job back in the editing room was to transfer all the quarter-inch tapes to 16-millimeter magnetic film, which was the same size as the 16-millimeter film, so they could be matched up frame to frame. But I had to find the sync mark for each scene. So every single scene, and sometimes we didn't have a slate, and so it would require either looking at B's and P's, because you could tell when that was kind of like a percussive moment that you could assign. You know, first you had to sort of read the lips of the person to figure out what they were saying. Or you would notice in the background somebody closed the door and say, I've got a sync mark.
So how long did it take? Okay, so these films were 30, 40 minutes. And in fact, in the BAM PFA program, you put together, you know, two or three, whatever number for a particular program, because they were short films. How long did each of the films take to edit then?
I calculated, this has changed because of all the footage that people shoot now, thousands of hours. I calculated at one point that it was like 1 month per 10 minutes for the editing, and probably a little bit longer than that. That was kind of a rough estimate. You know, so the Tommy Gerald film was 30 minutes, so it was 3 months.
Did you have kind of B-rolls that you were able to just add?
Oh, yeah. Les was really good at that. Because he had been an editor himself and had been an editor, he knew that coverage was extremely important. And he didn't want to just have talking heads. He didn't like talking heads at all. He tried to avoid talking heads. So he was much more interested in, you know, spontaneous things happening between people, sort of like what we would call cinema verite. And he loved to gather images that would express where we were, where the film was taking place. So in Louisiana, we would just go out one day and roam the countryside, and he would film, you know, there was one scene where I had to go out in the marsh and yell to get this giant flock of beautiful white pelicans to fly up so he could film them flying around in hot, that became a beautiful scene in Hot Pepper.
How did he meet Chris Strachwitz, and what role did Chris play in facilitating all of the various documentaries about individual filmmakers?
I believe they met in L.A. at the Ash Grove, which was this wonderful coffee house that had this incredible array of music, from rock musicians to folk musicians to gospel singers to Appalachian players. I mean, it was a fantastic club. So, and then at a certain point, Chris told Les how much he loved his films, about especially the one about Mance Lipscomb, and asked him to do a film about Texas-Mexican border music, which became Chulas Fronteras. But I think Les definitely knew about Chris's involvement with Mance Lipscomb, Lightning Hopkins, and Cajun music. I think it was more of a compatibility that they found. I don't necessarily think that Chris introduced Les to those musicians, but he, I believe, has a credit for consulting on some of the films. And I think he might have provided some of the recordings on some of the films that Les used.
I also noticed that the address given for the production company was Down Home Music in El Cerrito.
Chris's film company was called Brazos Films. The address of Down Home Music, the record store, which still exists right now, fantastic place. And when they shot Chulas Fronteras in South Texas, Chris wanted him to edit in Berkeley. So he'd bought a building with proceeds from royalties he got from Country Joe McDonald's Fixin' to Die Rag, but that became famous with Woodstock. He opened a record store, and he had Arhuli Records in this building, and upstairs was Flower Films, where Les set up his editing room. So I came out from, I was living in Texas at the time, and I came out to be the Les assistant on that. So that's how I ended up here. And then Chris and Les kept this symbiotic relationship going by this film. And then later, Chris loved Chulas so much that he wanted Les to do the same thing with Cajun and Zydeco music, a lot of the musicians Chris knew and had recorded.
Werner Herzog, the sense I got was that Tom Luddy somehow played a role in that, and that eating the shoe for Errol Morris's film, that was how Les and Werner Herzog came together. Is that right?
Well, they had come together before that, but yes, through Tom Luddy, who was running the Pacific Film Archive at that point, and was often bringing in directors, including Werner Herzog. And Werner saw Les's films, Les saw Werner's films, and they liked each other's work. And Tom had to introduce them. He just thought that they would like each other. And sure enough, they did. And I just was rereading. There's a book called The Burden of Dreams book, and that includes Les's journal, my journal, some writings from Herzog and Michael Goodwin, who was with us at one point, journalist. And apparently Les and I had a dinner, went to dinner with Werner in Telluride, and that's when Les brought up the idea of making a film about Werner making a film, which was in the Peruvian Amazon, which eventually became Fitzcarraldo.
And that film, of course, is pretty much Les's mainstream legacy, because it turns out that Fitzcarraldo, who was kind of an obsessive explorer who wanted to create an opera house and bring Enrico Caruso to the middle of the Amazon, parallels Werner Herzog's creation of the film, in which he wants to take a boat and take it over a mountain in the middle of the Peruvian jungle.
That film, Les Blank's son, Herod Blank, has been doing everything he can in his power to preserve Les's legacy, which includes re-scanning or digitizing a lot of the films from their original components, negatives, and so forth, and then getting rid of dust and dirt and doing color correction. And in the case of Burden of Dreams, a new soundtrack, even. And that film is going to show in the end of July.
And it's also available on Criterion. I suspect it's the one film of Les Blank that you could probably rent streaming on various sites. There's sequences of Herzog just going off the rails talking. When you were filming that, what was going on through your mind? Because at some points he comes across as completely bonkers.
Well, have to give credit to journalist Michael Goodwin for bringing that out in him. He was having Michael was our assistant for a little while down there, and he was writing an article at the same time, which Herzog wasn't that happy about, but because they didn't want journalists. But Michael was talking to Werner, and Werner made some comment about the stars in the sky are just a mess. And he decided he better ask Werner this question at some point. And so it was pearls. It was like, you know, Hamlet's soliloquy. And especially when I was editing, it was like, oh, my God, this is really something. It was hard not to. There were more things I could have added, of course, but it's pretty profound.
There's so many interesting things in that film. Klaus Kinski refusing to drink the alcohol that the Indians drank, and substituting milk for that, trying to get that damn boat over the mountain. At the end, it's kind of weird because it's suddenly you're watching the boat, and then suddenly, okay, it's 6 months later, which meant you guys had left.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we couldn't stick around at a certain point, and because it was just taking forever. You know, our funds were running out, and we didn't know how long this would take. And it wasn't that long after we left, actually, that they succeeded. But we missed it. And so the footage that's in the film is from Werner's film. The little bit that is in there is from his film.
There's also, at the very beginning, a weird scene involving Jason Robards and Mick Jagger. And that, of course, came from Werner.
Yeah. In fact, it's probably the only footage from what he shot with Robards and Jagger that has been seen publicly because, you know, he had to kind of shelve all that footage. I think he shot like 40% of the film with those guys, and then they had to leave because Jason Robards got amoebic dysentery and his doctor didn't let him go back to the jungle, and Jagger had a tour coming up and he couldn't stay longer. So Werner was absolutely devastated by that.
Two of the films kind of go off in different directions. One of them is Garlic is Good as 10 Mothers, which is all about garlic, and the other is about gap teeth women. These are a little bit different than the others. What happened? Did he just become obsessed with these ideas?
Well, Les fell in love with garlic, and I mean, it became part of, it was his staple, and I fell in love with garlic after working with Les. I eat it every day in my omelets, you know. But he would have a clove with him in his pocket wherever he went to lunch. Anyway, I think he started getting interested when Alice Waters started having her Bastille Day, 14th of July, garlic dinners. He filmed one, and then a year came around, and he said, oh, better film the other one. And so I think we filmed three in a row, and he started to get interested in the idea of garlic and this cultural phenomenon and all the different cuisines that use it and the cultures that were involved. And I just think that he thought that there was something great you could do with this topic. And then the same thing with gap-toothed women. He apparently, in his youth, was sort of fascinated by women who had gaps in their teeth, and especially after reading Chaucer in his English classes about the gap-toothed woman who supposedly was a little oversexed. And so he wondered, you know, about these gap-toothed women. Indeed, are they?
Well, it turns into a feminist tract, actually.
That was kind of a different angle than maybe Les was originally thinking, but there were three women involved in this production, and we said, Les, you can't just make this, you know, you got to do something different with this film. So Chris Simon, who worked with him for many years and was married to him for 20 years, and Susan Kell was this wonderful woman that worked with us, and she ended up auditioning all the gap-toothed women, and she kind of helped pick who we would have in the film. We got people to tell their stories about their gaps, but also about their lives, so that there's this wonderful array of everything from a belly dancer to to musicians to
Lauren Hutton
to moms to, you know, all different kinds of women, truck driver.
I noticed that the film series ends, I think the last one was the Maestro, King of the Cowboy Artists. And after that, until I began looking around, it seemed that was the end of his career. But in fact, he went digital. At that point, were you kind of moving away from him?
Yeah, I was sort of moving on, feeling like I wasn't moving up, shall we say. I couldn't move up anymore. And I mean, I usually got sucked back in because Les would come up with these great ideas. But he was also sort of winding down a little bit. But then he ended up working with Gina Lebrecht, who he did All in This Tea, about David Hoffman, who has this incredible place in Marin and was a tea importer. And then a film about Ricky Leacock, the director, the wonderful documentary director.
How to Smell a Rose.
How to Smell a Rose, yes, yes. So these are Les's digital forays, and they're pretty wonderful, and they're showing as well.
Oh, they are?
Mm-hmm. Those two are showing. Mm-hmm.
They're not on Criterion, though, so I didn't get to see them.
Maybe by now they are, because Herod's been working to get everything on Criterion.
Well, he died in 2013. Cancer, was it?
Yeah. I guess it was about the diagnosis, it was about a year. At a certain point, he was started chemo, like in the, it was like a spring when he got the diagnosis, and then it was kind of late when he started treatment, chemo, and then when he was taking the chemo, he said, I can't live like this, I can't live like this. And he just decided not to do chemo and instead just live, have more quality of life. It was quite something. We were expecting that he would be gone by January, and he lasted till April. And he had a wonderful team around him taking care of him, including Chris Simon, his sons, Herod Blank and Beau, and Herod's girlfriend at the time, Alicia. And they just totally took care of him. Oh, and Susan Kell, a woman involved with Gaptooth Women. And Herod filmed a lot of the process and was determined to get Les telling as many stories as possible before he died. And anyway, it was quite something.
Has any of that surfaced?
Well, Herod's been trying to figure out what to do, how to deal with it.
And you, by that point, you had kind of moved on and you were creating your own work. Where does your work get shown now? I mean, the Chris Strachwitz film is finished and some of these other films. I found listings for them on your website, maringoslin.com. Where do these get shown? Where can people see them?
This Ain't No Mouse Music is going to be on the Criterion Collection. And we just updated the website, so now it's all in nice shape. NoMouseMusicFilm.com. And the Barbara Dane film is my newest film. And it's just getting going. It's just getting started. And so it's at film festivals. And there's going to be the screening at the PFA on June 26th, First Bay, East Bay screening. And we just signed with a Canadian distributor for that film. And we're looking for a U.S. distributor. And Blossoms of Fire has been out of distribution for such a long time, and I'm trying to get it back in.
So it's a struggle, just as any writer has a struggle keeping their own work in print. I want to mention something that happened, my connection here, along with, of course, having known Chris Strachwitz and Michael Goodwin from the old days at KPFA. In 1978, I was briefly the person in charge of promoting the KPFA Crafts Fair, and I received, I guess it was a 30-second stop-motion film, could have been longer actually, which I rejected because it was a little bit too funky and 16mm for the KPFA Crafts Fair from Les Blank. Any idea what happened to that film? You said you heard of it.
I remember hearing about it, and I remember him filming it, but I don't remember what happened to it. I wonder if Herod has come across it in all of the research he's done with all the films. We'll have to ask him.
That would be great. It would be great to see Les Blank's take on KPFA. did he listen to KPFA?
Oh, yeah, and listen to Chris Strachwitz's show.
So what are you working on now, Maureen Gosling?
Well, getting the Barbara Dane film out into the world. That's a big job, actually.
And that's finished.
That's finished. And it just got a second best documentary prize last weekend, Vermont Film and Folklore Festival. Then it'll be at the PFA. And then we're trying to get into a bunch of other film festivals. So this is a year of screenings, having all the screenings at the PFA, having Burden of Dreams coming out and showing around the country, you know, Barbara Dane film being in festivals, and also Bamako Chic, Threads of Power, Color and Culture, half-hour film that I did with a woman named Maxine Downs, shot in West Africa.
And also, since it took so long to shoot films and edit them, how many Les Blank films are still out there in the process of being created? Are they all done by now?
There's one that Herod Blank is just finishing about this outsider artist in Alabama named Butch Anthony. And so you can keep a watch out for that one. And that Les started that and tried to finish it, and Herod finished it. And Herod's finished a couple of shorts that Les started. Oh, there's one called Thailand Moment that's going to be showing, I think, the first weekend of the series. That was, again, a short film that Les shot with Skip Gerson that Herod ended up finishing. He got an editor to help finish that film. If there are films that exist that Les left hanging, Herod's trying to deal with them and finish them.
And one final question for you. It sounds in our discussion you're a little bit more political than Les. What kind of influence as the editor, I mean, you talked about it in Gaptooth Women, but what kind of influence did you as an editor have in kind of gearing a more political element to Les's films? Was there any?
Les's films were never overtly political. They were more non-verbally political, I think. They made lots of commentary without a political comment. But I have worked with a man named Jed Reif for the last 15 years, and we've made a bunch of films that were political. And so I've had a lot of influence from working with him. We did a film about medical marijuana. We did worked with a woman, the director, Frances Causey, a film called The Long Shadow about the legacy of slavery. We did one with Stephanie Welch on questions about genetics and eugenics, A Dangerous Idea. That's really affected me a lot, and I've actually really appreciated it because it does tap into my own interests a lot, and the Barbara Dane film kind of brings it all together because it's political, it's about music and a musician, it's got blues, it's got jazz, it's got folk, and it's got a woman. And so it's a great coming together of all these things.
Les never did make a film with a screenplay. Did he ever regret it? And you have not made one either. Do you ever regret it?
Les, he gave it one last try in, I think it was in the 80s. He got accepted in the Sundance Institute program where he could offer a screenplay which Michael Goodwin actually wrote and that Les would direct. In that program, he had all these great advisors to help him. And he had like Peter Coyote, who played one of the roles in his script. And after that experience, he said, I can't do this. I mean, the guy was quiet. He wasn't like out there, you know, telling people what to do. And I think he finally accepted the fact that he couldn't do it, that it was okay, you know. And I never wanted to. I love documentaries so much. And I love, as an editor, I love the mental exercise that and the emotional exercise I go through trying to put the stories together. And I just think that it would feel too much like paint by number if I were to do a feature film. I know there are feature editors who would disagree with that probably, but that's kind of my own little angle on it and why I love documentaries so much.
Financing documentary films, is it easier or harder these days?
It's probably harder because there are so many more filmmakers, less money, and lots of competition. And there's some really good filmmakers out there and good films that deserve to be made. But we're all competing for these little pots, you know, and it's very hard. These films these days, average of 5 years, maybe the longest it's taken me is like 10. And, you know, how many decades do I have left, you know?
You've been listening to an interview with Maureen Gosling, who will be introducing several of the films of Les Blank at BAM PFA, Berkeley Art Museum, Pacific Film Archive, June 7th to July 27th. You can get more information by going to bampfa.org.
Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.